Processes and tools dominate today's Agile discussions, but we are devoted to the individuals and interactions that make it work. From the beginner to the veteran practitioner, we have something for you. Welcome to Agile for Humans.
All right, everybody, it's Ryan Ripley. We're about to start this week's episode of Agile for Humans. But before we get started, a few things I wanted to tell you about. First of all, the Patreon effort. All of you have stepped up and have really shown a lot of love to the show. And right now we've got a number of Patreon people to catch up on. I want to start with Andrew Sheingold, starting out at the $25 reward level, Manuel Gomez at the $10, Amitai Schleyer at the $5. We have Jack Burnham and Paul Winey helping us out at $1 a month. That money goes right back into the show, everybody, and I really appreciate the support so far. I really love the fact that people are stepping up with their hard-earned cash and saying, yes, Agile for Humans is valuable. We appreciate it. We're going to help out. Totally optional. Agile for Humans, it's always free, and it will be free from now until it ends, hopefully in the very, very distant future. But I really love it that people are stepping up with Patreon. If you want to check it out, there's links to the Patreon site on the show notes. Always love and appreciate the support. Please share the show. Show us a little love on iTunes. 5 stars helps out a lot, but please be honest. Also want to tell you about Coaching Beyond the Team. So Esther Derby and Don Gray are bringing their course to Columbus, Ohio. So right in the Midwest, right in my backyard. Really excited about that. Right now, it's April 3rd through the 5th, Columbus, Ohio. If you go to ryanripley.com/CBTT, you can check out Coaching Beyond the Team with Esther Derby and Don Gray. I will be there. You get to hang out with me. We'll do a workshop together, hopefully hang out, do dinner, all those things that go with attending a workshop. But I'll be there. I'm excited to be there. It's at the Ohio State University Union. Beautiful venue. It's where Path to Agility is every year, the COHA conference that we love and support. So, hey, let's do a workshop together. RyanRipley.com/CBTT. Hope to see all of you there. All right, let's get into the show. This week's guest is John Cutler. You know, John is a huge product guy, well-known for his Medium blog. He does the Hacker Noon, or he's part of the Hacker Noon. Really insightful guy, prolific writer. I really love this this episode. So let's take it away. John, how are you, sir?
Yeah, I'm doing great. Yeah, glad to be here.
Yeah, you've been posting some stuff lately, John, that's getting a little bit of attention. That might be one of the things we talk about tonight. But a recent post, and I love the title. It was something about why Agile doesn't work. What's going on there, John? Because I think you've inadvertently started a little flame war online.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. We were talking a bit about this before we got started, but I tend to write the title at the end of these posts, and I'm going to be completely transparent. I have a hang up about the titles because the smarter I try to make the title, the fewer the people that are going to read the post. It is literally, there's a correlation, literally. If I try to, you know, anyway, so then I got into writing posts with numbers in them, you know, and there was this post about feature factories and like that. And I would love to say I was even purposely trying to be provocative with the title, but literally it was, you know, it's about 1:20 in the morning. It's quiet. I'm doing my best thinking and work, and I just had to get this out there. And the title, Why Isn't Agile Working, comes directly from a relative of mine, actually. And this relative is a CEO of a technology company that works in the insurance space. And I remember a long afternoon we spent together in Dallas, Texas, when I was visiting. And he started to ask a little bit what I was doing. We hadn't been in touch for a long time. And then he was talking about some agile transformation in his company and just how angry and frustrated he was. And it actually resonated with me. And I've been thinking about it now for a couple years. But this was sort of, you know, straight what Scott said. You know, he said, why isn't this damn thing working? Why isn't this agile thing working? What the hell is going on here? And so that was the title. But yeah, I think that whenever you say the words not working or sucks or versus or the end of or beyond or any combination of things like that, people have a certain visceral reaction.
So what kind of reactions are you getting? Like, are you getting great content? Are you getting good comments? Are you getting, hey, what do you mean it doesn't work? Are you getting those snap reactions?
Yeah, I think that that's why, you know, I mean, I've certainly written some things where people are like, this is the most idiotic thing ever. But yeah, this, it's the snap reactions that I'm getting. And one odd thing I'm getting about this post is, and in this way, I feel I got supremely lucky. But in this post, I actually talk about pretty mundane things. At least I perceive them to be mundane. Things about flow efficiency or multitasking or debt. And I get a lot of people who say to me something like, oh my God, this is exactly what's been bothering me, but I haven't been able to put it into words. And you drew a couple pictures and you explained it. So I get a lot of those. I do get a lot of responses that say things like, you know, don't blame the tool. We always get those. Don't blame the tool. Don't blame the practitioners. Then you get a lot of people who chiming in, developers saying things like, you know, I never trusted this thing anyway. It sucks. You know, can't we get back to doing work? So I would love to say that these are kind of unique reactions, but I think that they're just the traditional reactions you get when, you know, a couple hundred thousand people in our community see a title like that. So that's a little bit about, that's the type of feedback I've been getting. It's actually driven a bunch of direct one-to-one conversations with people. Ron Jeffries and I went back and forth about it on Twitter. And I think it actually resonated with some older school, It resonated with people who've been doing this for a long time as a kind of a nice, simple explanation of some of the problems they've been having. So I don't know, a variety of responses, Ryan, you know, I can't keep up with it. That's the problem at this point. So I'm trying to have a life as well.
Yeah, exactly. I read a lot of comments. I don't read all the comments, and you can't.
I bet with a podcast. Yeah, you can't keep up with and you also don't, and I'm sure you have this too. I'd love to hear your take on it. You also step back sometimes and realize that you are creating a point of view and a community with a point of view.
Right.
Even if it's and I'm sure you get this with the podcast, like you become a sum of the guests you've had and the viewpoints and the discussions that have happened. And it can be a little odd. How do you handle that?
Yeah, I definitely think that point of view has been shaped by the guests, right? So
right.
I'm unapologetically a fan of Scrum, and I believe in it, and I actually think it's an excellent way to do work, but not everyone agrees with that. And so that point of view, this is a very Scrum pro podcast. No estimates. You know, I have a lot of no estimates advocates come on the show because none of the critics are willing to actually speak in an open forum.
Right.
I've invited all of them. And the only one that stepped up was Steve McConnell. And Steve McConnell did a great job. We had a wonderful conversation. Really appreciated his participation, but he's the only one that will do it. But that's fine because he's also the most prominent and the most popular one. So that was a great show. But in the meantime, we've had 10 shows out of 80 that have been about a pro no estimate stance. And so suddenly, the idea is that I no longer believe in estimation or this show doesn't, which is the furthest thing from the truth.
Right.
I believe strongly in lean thinking. You know, the throughput or the cycle time drawings that you did, or where you show the waste or the waiting time. I love that stuff. You know, cumulative flow diagrams drive my teams. You know, I believe in looking at cycle time and looking at bottlenecks and trying to apply Reinerstein to wherever I can. I want to know what my flow efficiency is, and if we're at that 15% flow efficiency, which is pretty normal, how can we fix that? What are we waiting for? How can I map our value streams to figure out what's valuable and what isn't, and what's unplanned work, and what's, you know, what work was in our backlog, and what's coming in the back door, and how is that affecting our cumulative flow diagrams and our throughput and our lead time? And I'm all about that stuff. And if you want to be candid about it, that's estimation. Okay.
Right.
It's a valuable estimation to me. Some of the other types aren't, but You know, so those kind of personas come in where, oh, he's a scrum zealot, he's a no estimates hack, that kind of stuff comes into play. But you know what? I wouldn't change anything. And honestly, John, the way that I approach it is I try not to listen to it because it would change who I am and the type of show we do. And I think people like the show. You know, you and I have, we've only met online a few times, but we're able to get on here and have a fun conversation. And I think that's what people want. They want to learn from people like you and Woody Zuhl, you know, Jerry Weinberg, all the great people, the top thinkers. Like, you're one of the top product thinkers in our industry, and it's great to have you on here to be able to have you just talk. And and if we were worried about the personas we were creating or these viewpoints, I think it would take away from what we were saying.
Yeah. I relate a lot, actually, with what you're saying. And it's funny. I mean, I can even draw it into this particular piece that, you know, I think that there are a lot of us in the community that have a very broad palate. That's the best way I could describe it. You know, that we're thinking and kind of pattern matching across all these different interesting tools and mindsets and perspectives and things like that. And I think that the tendency is, you know, overlay that, let's say, with the consulting community, and, you know, everyone has to do their work and they're finding value out there. I was having a conversation today with someone that, you know, once you're selling something, you do have to kind of think about packaging and you know, what is that thing that you're offering? And one thing that I've noticed is that especially, you know, those among us who kind of weigh in and get involved in creating sort of content and trying to do the teaching part of it or the community side of it, and then also part, you know, work in the particular industry, I've noticed that it can be, that's one of those challenges where I think it can come across as certain people are extremely dogmatic about certain things, when maybe that's their sort of professional persona entering into the picture a little bit. Whereas if you're sitting, I always love this at conferences too, if you're sitting there with like a, you know, a couple drinks or whatever, coffee at the hotel bar, and then you really get to hear of all the things that are floating a person's boat at a particular point, it's completely overwhelming. It's one of the coolest experiences ever. To do that. I think one thing about this piece, I learn this every day, but simple visualizations and simple drawings can be so powerful. And I always forget this. I'm like a big doodler. I'm always doodling in notebooks. And I do have a fair number of tweets where I put little pictures and stuff. But I think that one thing I was trying to get at with this post was that we often beat ourselves up about very, very specific practices, whether it's in, you know, how the team is working, or we really beat ourselves up as a community. And if you take a step back and if you think about the system that we have going in a particular company, if you think about the global system, you start to realize that there's these macro trends inside, you know, how a company is working. There's these macro things. And I actually did a post recently called, you know, how to scale without imploding. And I kind of talked through that. That also actually got a fair amount of attention, where I talked through the various phases of scaling and the challenges you had. I was amazed at the number of people who wrote me and said, oh my God, I thought that it was only our company that was going through this. Oh my God, you know, I thought that this was, you know, negligence on the part of our CEO, but you helped me see that maybe there was another angle to it. And so I think what I was getting at with this Why Isn't Agile Working piece was, we beat ourselves up a lot, and we often beat teams up a lot about their particular practices. But if you step back and if you think about the whole picture of a company, and if you think about things like flow efficiency, if you think about things like the amount of, you know, static or noise in the system that interrupts us, if you think about Agile as a risk mitigation strategy, but if you think about it in terms of delivery risk and benefits risk, for example, it's really kind of comforting, oddly comforting, because I think that we get so intense in the industry about beating up on individuals and continuous and beating up on ourselves too, just continuous improvement. We got to continue. We got to eke everything we can out of this team or what we're doing. And we don't take a step back. And I think that's a little bit what I was trying to get at with this.
Oh, I agree with that. I think that we take it even further. So we got to continuously improve it. Now we need a way to measure it. And we need a way to forecast it. And it's like, wait a minute, this is a team thing. What are we doing here? And you know, what I find is, as I've gotten older, John, we are kind of turning into the old guys. You know that, right?
Oh, crap.
I know. It's a good thing that it's happening. It's much better than the alternative. But what's happening in my thinking, at least, is that I do have very strong opinions. But I've learned to hold them loosely.
Yep.
And so I have these very strict thoughts about Scrum and estimation and all of these things. But when data is brought forward, I change them. I can change them with evidence and with proof and with, you know, logic and thought. And I think that's part of the difference too, right? I think it's, we can have, as a community, we can have opinions. We can have these very passionate discussions. You know, sometimes we beat ourselves up. Sometimes we're a little rough on our colleagues. But at the end of the day, it's for that improvement. And if we're willing to be reasonable and a little bit movable, like I'm willing to move a few inches on my views. I know you certainly are. I think that's where the improvement comes from. So I've tried to really watch a lot of that stuff too. And you know, yeah. I don't know about you, but I've pulled away from the holy wars a little bit. I no longer care what safe, if whether or not safe is or isn't agile. If that's as good as it gets at certain companies, go for it because it's better than some oppressive, unfair, opaque waterfall type mode of working, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's kind of where I'm drifting towards. I still have these strong opinions, but I'm not going to fall on the sword for many of them.
You know, it's funny that it's interesting you say that is if you think about, you know, empirical process control, or if you think about, I think a vast majority of the whatever, older agilists or the people in the community that are doing this, most people believe in that kind of meta form of continuous improvement. So I've been thinking about this a lot lately where it's kind of, we can talk about continuous improvement in very prescriptive terms, and then we can talk about how do we improve upon how we improve, if that makes sense.
Right.
So, you know, and I think that that's what those of us in the community really need to grapple with, because we are the ones proposing the tactical continuous improvement, you know, the medicine, right? So, like, we're often in a position. I'd like to think that we often hopefully step back and let the team kind of think about their own medicine and stuff. But we're often in a position where we're tossing out ideas about how to fix things. But I think that we also have to engage very deeply in improving upon how we improve. And I think that that's something that people who are involved from a coaching standpoint and from other things have to take pretty seriously. I would love it if companies took that seriously as well, right? One thing I've noticed is it's almost hard enough to get to a company to think beyond we're implementing my idea or your idea to, hey, let's continuously improve, to, hey, let's reassess how we're improving. Is that working, if that makes sense? So I don't know. I think it's a burden. It's a little bit of a burden that when you're deep in the community of coaching or consulting or helping that, and I think that we need to be kind to ourselves about it. It's tough work to always be kind of having to operate on a couple levels for doing this. I think that another thing that I don't know about if you've gone here lately, but I've really been starting into I read a great book about scaling. The name of the author is actually escaping me at the moment, but it's the book title is something like Scaling the Fundamental Laws About How All Things Scale, something like that. And it talks about scaling in socio-technical systems, in biological systems, and all sorts of things. And it's really, really, it was an incredible book because it really forces you to step back from being in the weeds in a particular company that you're in or in a particular environment and look at the trends of what happens to companies. Companies die. Companies become zombies. Often, despite our best efforts, companies become zombies. You know, companies go back to some of the core decisions they made in the first 2 years of their existence, and they never fully escape those particular decisions. And nor can anyone, right? There's a lot of interesting macro trends when it comes to thinking about organizations and socio-technical systems that I think that as practitioners, we'd love to believe that there is the low-hanging fruit. Oh my God, flow efficiency is going to go from 10% to 40%. The CEOs are going to become, you know, these Svengali leaders. Hopefully not Svengali leaders. Actually, that's like the absolute worst term for a leader. You know, I don't know, like humble leaders or something. And
how about just servant leaders?
Servant leaders, yeah, we're good. Svengali is like the absolute opposite. The problem is I know so many Svengali CEOs that I was grafting my knowledge of CEOs onto the problem, which was funny. But anyway, you get what I'm saying, that like we beat ourselves up. And what that's actually made me realize, and I'll go on a little bit longer on this question because it's giving me an idea here, but is that this is about us and our relationship with work. It's about us and our relationship to ourselves, our self-identity, and our identity of our communities. And what I love about Agile for Humans, it is about the human side of this. Because when people talk about saving companies or, you know, oh my God, the low-hanging fruit at that company, and oh, micromanagement, and oh, middle management, or oh, everything would be okay if managers fixed everything they did, or we're really talking about creating humane places for us to be challenged and to explore our self-identity and our work. And we're doing that as practitioners as well. So when you get into these extended debates about Scrum or Safe or anything, or oh my God, you know, remove the managers or anything, we're often talking about our own relationships to work. We're talking about what makes us feel good, what makes us feel needed, and the environments where we feel trusted and wanted and have impact. So anyway, long story short, I think that if you think about those couple things I talked about, like the macro trends of business, things are going to die whether we help them or not in many cases. And then that extremely personal connection we have to work. I really hope that my personal trend lately has been don't beat ourselves up, focus on people, focus on the humans involved, do what you can for continuous improvement, move on when it doesn't make sense, and take that more human angle. So it's been a progression, probably even since we last spoke. That's where my head's at lately.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting view. We actually just recorded a show about the spine model, and I'm not sure if you've seen this before, but it's essentially starting at what needs are we trying to meet?
Right.
What do we value? What are the principles that we're going to use to maintain our values and meet needs? And then what are the practices and what are the tools? And what I like about what you're saying is I can map this in my mind back to moving the conversation back up that spine. You know, because we spend a lot of time beating each other up over tools and practices, right? And improving tools and practices. But when we really get into the individuals and interactions, we start moving up to principles.
Yep.
And that's an interesting conversation. And then what do we value? Well, we learn what we value through the principles we adhere to. Well, then how we value, you know, then our values are influenced by the needs we're trying to meet of our own and of our customers and of our teammates. And so that's where, to me, I think our head spaces are pretty similar right now, and that I'm really interested in, you know, those first three levels of conversation and discovery. And the practices and the tools are becoming kind of secondary to me.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. And I think that this is the challenge as you get, and again, this is why I love it. This is about us as humans and in our own careers too, because as we develop, I'll tell an interesting story. I'm participating in this book club that I put on, and the author of the book had a table in the book, a very interesting table for how to handle a certain problem. And I actually found myself saying, I'm not going to look at this table right now, but I know it exists. Like, I've put this, I've pattern matched this table against the problem sets that I have. And when I need this table again, I'm going to come back to it. In fact, I've kind of hit the limit on my RAM is full, right? So it's really interesting. I think that the challenge that we have, those practitioners, is, you know, when you go into a room filled with 20-somethings or people who are earlier in their career, it's not an age thing, just kind of earlier in terms of things, they really do gravitate towards the more concrete tools and practices, right? So I find myself juggling that constantly, where I've hit the limit. I know the tools that exist and know the worlds of the tools out there. I've hit the limit on the amount I can hold in my brain at once about that stuff.
Right.
I can access them when I need them. I understand the traditions that are out there. But then, goodness, I know that when I go in and talk to someone who's less experienced with this, I need to slow the F down.
Yeah.
Right? Because, man, I'm going at 100 miles an hour.
It is.
So, I don't know if you've noticed that same thing. It's an interesting dynamic as you start to develop the tool set, I think.
Yeah, it's a fire hose. And I've screwed up those conversations. I remember very early on, in a Scrum Master gig, a project manager came to me, and she was just very interested in Scrum. And I just went 1,000 miles a minute, man. I was like, oh, we got to do this, and it's self-organization. Just blasted her with 10 years of Scrum theory in like 10 minutes. And it turned that person off. It was just,
yep.
I don't understand this. I'm never going to understand all this. So I'm just going to go away. And I'm going to, and that person turned, ultimately, someone, we're in a mentoring relationship now where we have a lot of great conversations, talk to each other about improvement. But at that time, I mean, I almost turned away one of the most talented agilists I know today.
Huh. And, fascinating.
It was crazy. But eventually I just went back and said, what need are we trying to fill here? And she finally was able to just talk to me. And what I learned in that moment was, ask more questions, talk less, listen more, and you'll probably do well. And so by asking what's wrong, what need are we trying to fill here, she was miserable telling people what to do as a project manager. She hated having to crack the whip and have the carrot and the stick mentality. And so we were just able to talk about servant leadership. So we had a nice 30-minute conversation about that. And then every couple of days we'd have lunch and talk about one next topic, you know, and it turned into a conversation. Here's the thing. I think a lot of the time when we're talking to someone, it's not a long-term investment. Mm. You know, what we're doing is we're having a 10-minute talk. We're trying to move on to the next thing. And when we treat people and interactions like that, you don't get great results. When I've taken a longer term view, like you and I hope we'll talk for the next 20 years. You know, I hope people listening to this podcast will become the next wave of agilists, and they'll come on here, or my show will become so dated that I've got to go on their show and beg them to tell me what the cool new thing is. You know, I hope all that stuff happens, but it's a long term view. Like, there's an investment in a relationship. There's an investment. This is an ongoing discussion. And I think far too often, I know I'm guilty of this, there are times where I'm not making that long-term investment and I'm really messing up that conversation.
Hmm. Yeah, this happens a lot with the writing. And, you know, I kind of float between a bunch of different communities. I think there might be like 6 of them or 8 of them. And it's very interesting to me because I think that, I would say, okay, I'm going to totally just guess. I'm going to say that 60% or 80% of the dialogue on Twitter, in these different forums, are much more about posturing our own self-identity and core sort of beliefs and our defense mechanisms and our the adrenaline that comes with creating social capital, you know, the endorphins. I would say that the bulk of the conversation is about that. It's almost an automatic level of response. And the the type of deep understanding that's required to, I really like what you said about the sort of long-term view of these things. You know, we talk a lot about business being sped up and all these particular things, but our own bodies are being sped up. Yeah. Cognitively, we're being sped up. You know, the ability to scan, you know, 300 notifications in Twitter and sort of say, oh my God, I got to respond to that and not that. And what's this and what's that? And what's this person complaining about? And what am I complaining about? Right? So, you know, it's kind of fascinating when you do think about it from that level. But back to what you're saying, the ability to take the longer term view, to slow down and to have meaningful interactions that evolve, that are not like stateless interactions, which is kind of fascinating. The whole getting things done, you know, get things out of your inbox sort of idea is about it being stateless. It's done. It means it's actually out of your mind, right? So when someone or one or to post, you know, the snarky reply back on Twitter, in some way that's the stateless response. You've tried to come to a conclusion there that's actually, you know, whatever, psychologically pleasing to you that you're done with, and gets it out of your inbox, right? So it's just kind of fascinating to me how that all relates to building communities of practice and building sort of like lasting bodies of work and lasting things that people can draw from. I don't know. I find it fascinating. And man, if we could get everyone to meditate for 30 minutes in all of product development, that would improve our situation. You know what I mean? If you want to talk about low-hanging fruit.
Right? Just slow down a minute. Yeah.
Just slow down. And you know what? It's funny because I think that's a... When I'm scanning what people are putting out there these days, that is one of the big sort of big boulder rock principles that I see emerging from people is like, how do we slow down a little bit? We talk about faster, 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 agile, you know, tighten everything up. But I wrote a post that actually was meaningful, very meaningful to me, called Promises in Progress, PIP. And it was all about what is the actual sum total of the promises that an organization or an individual or a team has in progress? And what I realized when I put that post together was that in the average organization, and I've done this exercise with a couple teams where we dig into what the PIP is instead of the work in progress. And I am not joking that the work is like 30%. The promises in progress are the 70%. I'll get back to you on that. Oh, we should think about that. Oh, that's a good idea. Oh, maybe we should try to always do X while we're doing the work. Maybe we should try to check in with ourselves. Or even weirder ones like cultural promises, customers first. That's a promise. That's a promise the organization is trying to make. And so as I started to think about the PIP stuff, and I will relate this to moving faster, is that, man, we're hitting our limits of sort of cognitive processing, the human cognitive processing unit, right? So it's the PIP that drags us down, not necessarily the work. And that started to mean a lot with me in figuring out how to try to slow down and how to meditate and how to think deeply about all the promises I'm throwing off all the time. Like, you organized this awesome day of recording for Agile for Humans, and that probably involved a ton of promises. you were making a promise to yourself, you know, like it's deep.
Yeah, it's a full day, and it's getting people. You're right. There's a lot of promises in process here.
Yeah. So I don't know. Anyway, back to the idea of slowing down. I think that I see that mentioned a lot these days, and I think that that's a trend that I'm seeing emerging. Is everyone's talking about fast, 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 agile's faster, move faster, do whatever faster. And I think that that's missing out on the real sense of, if agility is about the ability to change direction and to learn, and we're being cognitively taxed to the max in our organizations, then the bottleneck is ourselves, our ability to process learning. And in an environment where our processing units are overwhelmed, of course we're just going to focus on shipping fast. Because that's the only thing that we can control in that environment. So I don't know. I'm going in on this, but I've been thinking a lot about promises in process.
Yeah, I actually think promises in process have, I think they've been detrimental to me lately. I will sometimes struggle with saying no. Mm. And when you make too many of those promises, you end up missing commitments, and then people are definitely upset. And I definitely have felt the effects of promises in process, and that really resonates. That's and it's because it's hard to visualize, right?
Yeah.
So a team can works with their product owner, and there's a product backlog, there's a sprint backlog, there's a sprint goal. All of that's up on the wall. All of that's very visible. But the promises that you make in the hallway, or the implied promises by a question or a statement, and all the assumptions surrounding them stay very, very hidden and not transparent. And they come back rearing their ugly head in full force sometimes. That's interesting.
Yeah, I've been going deep on it and thinking about what it means, and this idea of, because really at the end of the day, and I this is the sort of Zen part of whatever Kanban method or whatever you want to say. The idea of work in progress, let's get 50,000 feet above. I don't care whether it's a sprint on a sort of high level, a sprint or a work in progress constraint or an Andon cord or any number of things. It's a forcing function. And it's a forcing function to catalyze continuous improvement of some kind or reflection. Yeah. The interesting thing about promises in process for me is that if you go up on the 40,000 or 50,000 foot level about the stuff we do with Scrum or Kanban or work in progress constraints or sprints or Andon cords or whatever, a lot of these things basically are forcing functions, right? So they're a forcing function that is supposed to be a catalyst for continuous improvement,
right,
of some kind. And I think that gets mangled in Scrum, and I think it gets mangled in Kanban, and I don't care where it is, it gets mangled. So when everyone talks about abuse, it gets abused everywhere, right? The forcing function becomes something different. You're not thinking about the purpose of this constraint that you're creating. The interesting thing about promises in progress or process is that, again, it's that visualization thing, but we haven't figured out how to have effective forcing functions for our promises. And when you make forcing functions for your promises, they feel really freaking awkward.
Yep.
You know, it's about saying to someone, I worked with a CEO who would say everything's a great idea. You know what he didn't realize every time he said that was a promise. Because if you come up with an idea and your CEO says, that's a great idea, that's a kind of tacit encouragement on that particular thing. And you've actually got a little mission going that you're going to create that thing. Or you're going to move that thing forward. Or if someone says, you know, we'll do better next time, that's a promise. So what it occurred to me is that the challenge is that the forcing functions around our promises are a lot tougher, a lot more human, a lot more personal. They require saying to someone like, hey, I'm going to forget you said that to me. You know, like, that's a pretty awkward thing to say to someone. Or I'm at my limit. And that's the one that I'm struggling the most with. I don't know about you, is that everything in this community about in the life hacking community or the productivity community is how to handle more. And if we take a lean approach to our own cognitive processing thinking, it's like, no. And the ability to go into a point where you might have all the answers as a coach or a practitioner and say, I cannot say another word. Because I will be creating more promises for the team. I will be creating more promises for myself. That's about self-discipline and team discipline. So I don't know, I've said a lot, but I think forcing functions for work mean one thing, forcing functions for promises and process mean another thing. They require different skills, and they require a lot of self-awareness, I think.
Well, and they're deeply personal. And right. So it requires a lot of psychological safety. Work in process, things can carry over to the next sprint. The team doesn't necessarily get chastised, and they really shouldn't happen, but you can meet your sprint goal and not get everything done that you intended to get done. And so you can still have success. You break one promise out of 100 during a sprint or a period of time, and it's a totally different feeling.
Yep.
I mean, it is a totally different beast, and you know, these mechanisms that you're talking about, I mean, they're far more severe. I mean, it's one thing to be told, well, our scope got a little out of hand. We reined it in. We preserved the sprint goal, but there's some work that we need to do next sprint to get that feature back on the backlog. Great. There's another thing to say, you broke this promise to me. And that's,
and you think it's huge, because if you look at this idea of normalization of deviance or drift into failure, or any of these ideas, or just basic organizational entropy. I mean, these are some different ideas. One of the central, it's easy to talk about a system. Oh, well, we used to check this system once every 3,000 miles, it works, and now we check it 9,000 miles, then we checked it 15,000 miles, and, you know, little did we know that, a black swan event was going to come out and the plane was going to crash.
Right.
I mean, that is a drift into failure. That's a normalization of deviance. That's some kind of concept like that. This is a fascinating one for me. In my article about, scaling and imploding, what I really realized is when everything's in front of you and when stuff works, you see it doesn't, it works. When it doesn't, you see it doesn't work. When it takes a long time to onboard an employee, everyone knows that. It's all very in your face. It's all very transparent. The number one thing that you get with scaling, the reason why you get the drift into failure, is all those feedback mechanisms start to encounter little hiccups.
Yep.
And someone said it the other way. It's like, it's better to make a ton of small promises than to make a one big occasional promise and then drop the ball on things. So this is actually kind of funny, because it goes straight to Scrum. It goes straight to any type of iterative type development. And it also comes to the organizational's need sometimes to create fake commitment points and fake promises, right, to build that trust. So this is an interesting dynamic, I think, where it's, can we create humane and sort of meaningful touch points and sort of forcing functions for trust so that we can rebuild our communities if things go off track? Or are we creating trust proxies? Are we creating promise proxies? And I think that, Tim Ottinger goes into this a lot about, what are we hiring the process to do? But if what we're hiring the process to do is to somehow soft land a crash landing of trust or promise keeping, man, that's going to get you into trouble. You're never going to get anywhere with that process to do that. So I don't know. I've said a lot, but it is a deep, deep topic that I've been getting into a lot lately, personally and with organizations. But a lot of it too, I'll give you a great example. You join a company and the company is known as being kind of innovative with their approaches and as being maybe someplace that's open to communicating when things aren't working. That's a promise that you've engaged in with the company. Maybe that was the sell when you joined the company. Maybe that's what the recruiter told you. Maybe that's what the CEO says at every single meeting. When we have an insane ability to sense lack of coherence in our work. I think humans are coherence sensors. And so what I notice is that central promise broken can destroy a company. The central promise of, this is a great place to work in, we believe in giving you autonomy and trusting people to get the work done. If you break that promise, you've lost something extremely important for that company. So it's a pretty deep concept. I mean, you can use promises for anything, but I don't know, for you, how would you contrast commitments with promises? That's an interesting one.
Commitment is something that I look at a little differently than other people. I see a commitment not being to an outcome.
Yeah.
I see a commitment being to values. I see a commitment being to, whether it's a framework or to teammates, I see a commitment being this intrinsic type thing. I see a promise being a promise is within an expected or intended outcome. And I make the differentiation that way.
It's interesting. Yeah. And we could go, I'm probably a little bit on the, that's an interesting one, because I could see how promises could be, we promised uphold this value. right? So that gets a little meta, right?
Right,
you know,
right.
It's like, that's like a commitment. And, you know, I think the Venn diagram between commitments and promises are interesting. I think that the upshot for the promises thing, and I think this happens a lot with coaching, I see a lot of coaching groups get together and put a lot of change in progress. So I would have promise in progress, work in progress, and change in progress. And they are all very serious about their careers. They want the best for their teams. And they make a lot of commitments. They make a lot of promises to each other about things that they hope to do with their work, or promises to themselves. And I think that's the thing. Commitments and promises can be made to yourself. And they just swamp the org. You know, they swamp the org with change. And they do it at a rate that can't really be processed by the people. So, yeah, it's an interesting one. But the main realization, the big picture realization, is that what we call work is just a small amount of what's taxing our cognitive load. It's that developer who says, but you told us we'd be able to iterate on that. Or it's that person who says, we made a commitment. Yeah, we made a promise or a commitment to really respect quality here. And I don't think we're keeping that promise to our customers or other people. I'd say much more than work, that weighs on us. And I think it's important to talk about.
I think it's incredibly important. One that comes immediately to mind is, you know, you promised that swag estimate that you coerced us into giving wouldn't be used or held against us.
Oh, that's a great one.
And
exactly.
I've seen this over and over and over, where the team gives a range and they put a disclaimer and they put the watermark across it saying, this is nonsense, don't make decisions based off of this.
Right, right, right.
And then suddenly that's the date.
Yeah.
And you're right. People, there's a continuity problem there. That one's pretty obvious, but it's even in the small comments made by the CEO that you mentioned, or just the way things play out. I agree. I think we're very good at seeing the continuity issues, and we're kind of detectors that way. And man, it's demoralizing. I think back to the conversation we had about how companies can just kind of, entropy kicks in and they die. I think that's kind of that first step. If you're not really watching those promises in process and the effects of that lack of continuity when it comes to promises not being kept, I think that's the path down the road of some of those problems.
You could also think about it as zombies. And this is the other thing I think that this is the little bit of the elephant in the room in all this. Look, you can have a successful company where most of the people in the company are pretty happy to work there. They're not really growing. It might even be a political place to work at and uncomfortable, but it's a little bit of like The Walking Dead. You know, it's not, I think that the rate of amount of time companies stay on the Fortune 50 is 500 has dropped by a lot. Like, I think this book about scaling that I was reading, it might be like almost all companies die in 5 or 7 years, meaning they are either acquired, you know, absorbed into other companies or other these particular things. So I think the little bit of the elephant in the room is we do have options when we create our socio-technical systems and our companies, whether to what promises that we make, you know, to each other. And I think that's, I say it's the elephant in the room because I think that people would like to say that unless you do X, Y, and Z, your company's going to suck and it's not going to make any money. But you could argue that a company that lasts for 20 years that doesn't necessarily choose to innovate wildly. I say this a lot with Scrum and Safe and other things like that. Let's say you're a pretty successful company, and someone says, oh, you have to turn everything upside down or otherwise your company's not going to exist. And you work at that company or you're a manager at that company, and you might say to yourself, you know what? Maybe you're right, but there's not really an imperative. I don't need to participate in this mass agitation of this company to try to change it into something else. You know? And as much as I know the community loves to talk about saving companies, I think we need to talk about growing people. And I'm that guy now. I used to kind of laugh at people who would say that because I'd be like, no, you could save the company. Like, we have to think about business. We have to think about why we're doing this, which is to, you know, I was very product centric. So I would be like, it's all about the customers, you know, but now I'm doing anything too, man. If you're not caring for the people in the system, and if you're just trying to save the company or do anything at all to help the customers, you're kind of missing some of the opportunity. But that's just my bias. I'm pretty biased on that now.
No, I think you're right. I think that's a great place for us to end, because we need to keep our promise to the listener to not go past an hour.
Yep. Yeah, this is so great. I really appreciate talking with you.
I love it too, John. I hope we can find a way to do this even more often, because this hour flew by, and I feel like we could probably do 3 more hours just on this topic.
So, yeah, it's been maybe we'll do a follow-up, bring some other folks in. I'd love to hear some other perspectives on promises and companies dying and The Walking Dead and all that kind of stuff. It would be fun.
Yeah, I think we'll try to make that happen in the near future, because I think this is a topic, this is in the back of the minds of many people.
Yep.
I think we all, it's something you sense, but maybe you can't articulate. I have a feeling this will set some people, some thought in motion. So I appreciate you doing this. This is the part of the show, John. You're a veteran. You know what's about to happen. What do you have to promote? What do you have going on? How can people continue the conversation with you? Be sure to plug your Medium site, which we will get in the show notes. And just anything else you want to get in front of the listeners.
Oh, same old. Medium's my place. It's easy. That's where I write. Twitter is where I hang out because it's easy. And yeah, I'd like to actually encourage some people to send me doodles and drawings. I'm super into the sort of the mind maps that people are creating these days and other ways of visualizing our promises, our work, strategy, and missions and stuff. That's been a kind of pet interest of mine lately. So, you know, send along that stuff, over Twitter, or, put at John Cuttlefish in Twitter, a nice drawing. I'm into that stuff lately.
Very cool. So we'll get all of your contact info on that in the show notes, the blog site and all of that. John, just want to thank you again for doing this. These conversations go by way too fast. So
cool. All right. It's great chatting.
Yep. And as for me, your host, Ryan Ripley, Twitter is at Ryan Ripley, the website, RyanRipley.com. Hopefully that's where you're hearing this podcast. If not, you're probably on iTunes. If you are on iTunes, please take a minute, give us a nice review. 5 stars is always appreciated, but please be honest. If you'd like to even take the next step further in supporting the show, and of course, sharing it is the best way to support it. But if you'd like to join the Patreon effort, we do have a link on the website now where you can become a contributor through Patreon. This is an experiment we're trying out to see after months of people asking, how can they contribute? How can they help? Finally decided to do this. So we'll see where this goes. But, as always, everybody, you're sharing the show. The download numbers are just skyrocketing. We're gaining new listeners month over month, and it's because you, the listener, are sharing the show. You're sharing the value you get out of it. And I just can't thank you enough. So, and it allows me to reach out to great people like John and make it worth their while to have these conversations. And it's just your support leads to more conversations like this. So thank you, everybody out there, for listening. Thank you for sharing. And I hope you all have a great evening.
Thanks for listening to Agile for Humans. Let's keep the conversation going. Drop us a question on Twitter @AgileForHumans or visit agileforhumans.com.